Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. It's the start of the year once again, and as we said last time, we're going to do our overview of what things look like and where the trend lines are going. Jim, what is the biggest thing that's coming our way this coming year?
Less war, but more heavily publicized new wars. Indeed, that was the theme of the semi-annual wars update we published this morning in Strategy Page, the best of times, the worst of times, I called it, because wars have been constantly, since the end of the Cold War in 91, been fewer and fewer. In other words, fewer new ones start, and a lot of the old ones have finally, you know, sputtered to some kind of conclusion, well, sputtered to a halt. A lot of them never really end, but people get tired and what have you. What made a big difference at the end of the Cold War was the Soviet Union and its allies, its satellite states, including China, were keeping a lot of wars going because they basically supported any revolutionary who pretended to be communist. And that deal worked for decades and got a lot of people killed. But when the Russians, the Soviets went belly up, so did all their satellites. At least Germany was a great base for all sorts of, you know, nasty, you know, terrorists. Suddenly they evaporated because they had no more support. Like I say, a lot of the wars that have been going on for decades or generations, centuries, sputtered to an end because they no longer had that support. You know, it's like the old saying goes, you know, amateurs study tactics, professionals study logistics. And the Soviets had, for over 50 years, actually more than 60 years, provided the logistics for revolutionary movements, you know, worldwide. And that was gone. But new wars did start, but and some of them were quite bloody, like the one in Congo, which is still going on. But as Austin's, you know, reporting aptly demonstrates, the UN finally decided to get tough, and there's actually been more fighting and less slaughtering of innocent civilians in the last year. So while you still have a war going on there, it's less intense. So fewer people are being killed, and you see this throughout the world. Again, these are the kind of patterns that we describe that aren't really described much elsewhere, you know, except in the Pentagon and in various other military headquarters where they study these things closely. So what we're going to see are a few wars that are covered very intensely in 2014, including some non-wars, well, hopefully non-wars, like with China in the South China Sea. Well, all around China, they're basically threatening everybody but the Russians, and the Russians know they're next, with border disputes and what have you. But nobody's getting killed, except for that one Chinese pilot back in 2001 who crashed into an American reconnaissance aircraft. The war in Syria is undoubtedly going to get bloodier. It's going to get a lot of attention. It's going to get a lot of journalists killed, but that's where the money is. Terrorism, mostly Islamic terrorism, as we pointed out in a piece, I think yesterday or in the last few days, is concentrated in three countries, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq. And nearly half of the terrorist deaths are really related not so much to terrorism, although that's what it's called, and that's what a lot of it seems to be, and it happens to be Islamic terrorism because all the people involved are Muslim, but it's basically a push to nationalist, you know, uprising on the border. There are 40 million Pashtun tribesmen in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and they have been a problem. Well, let me put it this way. Alexander the Great complained about them. And, you know, they had been there long before Alexander showed up 2,500 years ago. And the way things are going, they'll be around for you know, another 2,500 years. They're one of those peoples who are tough. They're in the middle of nowhere, literally. And Occasionally, every once in a while, they stop fighting each other and say, you know, we should be united. We'd be a pretty nice country. I don't think so, but that's what some of them think. And at the moment, they're basically trying to wreck Afghanistan, the governments in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And, you know, it gets described, depending on the journalist and the political viewpoint of the newspaper, the media outlet, you know, as a liberation war, as a Islamic terrorist movement, as a separatist movement, you name it. But again, it's something that's been going on for a long, long time and makes the news because they account for over 40% of the terrorist deaths worldwide. Just in Afghanistan, the Pashtun areas, mostly of Afghanistan and Pakistan. So the wars that get covered do tend to be the more important ones. Nobody wants the Syrian civil war to end up with another terrorist state or, you know, some sort of post-Assad government that supports terrorists because they feel obliged to because the terrorists did so much of the fighting. Because that's basically what a lot of Western countries see happened in Libya, where our ambassador got killed in 2012 by Islamic terrorists. The New York Times and the Pentagon are still arguing over what kind of terrorists. That is important for all people around the world because while terrorism doesn't kill most of the people in the wars that are going on, they scare most of the people because the terrorists are basically threatening everyone. Whereas in Congo and in a lot of these wars going on in places like Sudan and what have you, it's purely local. They want to kill each other over territory, mostly over real estate, oil or what have you. But the terrorists, you know, are practicing international terrorism deliberately, and they get their message across because now we have this wonderful, you know, 24-hour news media outlets, and everybody's wired and connected, and so everybody gets every threat multiple times. And so that gets into the news. But in the real world, where you have, you know, when you count the number of dead bodies and the number of, you know, people being shot at, that is actually going down. So it is, as we said, the best of times and the worst of times.
Austin?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what. There are two things that Jim mentioned, media reality, where everyone gets every threat, and how that magnifies the perception of violence, I would say imminent violence. That's been a revolution, let's say, at least in the perception of armed conflict. Dan, I think one other revolution, what I'll call one of these meta strategic issues, is what's called the fracking revolution. You know, the discovery that you can commercially produce what's called tight gas and tight oil, predominantly in North America, but also you look at where some of these tight gas, natural gas fields are in Europe. Great Britain benefits from it as well. There's plenty out there we've had some comments on this on the strategy page as well. But what that does in terms of lessening the impact of a country in the Middle East stirring the pot in order to jack energy prices. And I'll give you a specific operation, closing the Straits of Hormuz, which is something Iran threatens with some regularity, and watching oil prices spike. There is a diminution of the ability for them to have that as a tool. I'm not saying it's immediate, but then it's not something that won't necessarily see all the effects in 2014. But that's something over the next 10 to 15 years to think about it. Let me go through a couple of other things. Jim mentioned China and South China Sea and China's what has been referred to as China's board game strategy, whether that's chess or Go, but certainly not checkers, or an old SPI, simulations publications type mega game. That's more like it. China has made a number of moves consistently, and we've discussed this on Strategy Talk before, of the last three decades of that they're asserting their territorial rights, both on land and particularly where we're aware of it, is in maritime boundaries, South China Sea being one, but the air defense identification zone expansion that we saw in November, right at the time Vice President Joe Biden was visiting Beijing, is an example of doing it on maritime boundaries. Big story there is a big story we've been watching for the since 2000, really. I think put a finer date on that, which is really the spring of 2011 when the P-3 Ares incident occurred, the U.S. intelligence plane. You're seeing was de facto, now it's more, it's not by de jure, it's not a treaty yet, but you see India and Japan increasing the kind of diplomatic attacks that imply a military alliance. South Korea and Japan have their spats, but that's become they're becoming more integrated in their ability to conduct anti-missile defense. Now that's towards North Korea, but they cooperate with the U.S. On that with a ballistic shield. So you're seeing India, Japan, South Korea, and I'll even toss in Singapore and Australia in that, even though Australia's not a frontline state, and Singapore isn't exactly, even though it sits on the Straits of Malacca, where the Pacific and Indian Oceans meet, and is a major transit point for Chinese, both industrial goods being sold, but also resources coming from Africa and the Middle East. You're seeing an alliance developing there. I noticed just about 10 days ago in a Indian newspaper that I was looking at for some India-Pakistan commentary had a long essay about India and Japan and their diplomatic contacts, and really what was behind it was an increased worry about an aggressive China. Let's talk about Arab Spring or 2014. I stay away from predictions, but I'm going to talk about a trend I've seen in Tunisia. Tunisia is being tested. The Ennahda Party, which is their Islamist party, and it's a moderate Islamist party, is running a caretaker interim government. They're making efforts to include secular elements, and they're fighting Al-Qaeda terrorists. They're still the good news story. Jim's covered repeatedly in past strategy talks the mess in Libya. I do want to take a shot at some of the mainstream media coverage about Libya. Oh, well, it's filled up with people who hate the U.S. Well, tell me what Muammar Gaddafi was, too. I mean, in his actions, Libya is in a self-inflicted mess. And Syria, let's jump to Syria. I'll come back to Egypt in a minute. Now, I think Jim's story there is that nobody wants it to become a terrorist base, but the secondary story, maybe it's not secondary, is Iraq again. Iraq is in a vice between the chaos in Syria, and Syria is an Iranian ally, and Iran. Now, how that vice closes or how it releases has been a big story since the U.S. November 2011, or at least pulled out its last forces. 2012, 2013, 2014, 2015, 2016, how Iraq deals with that vice, because Iran, to some degree, has taken on what the Soviets, Jim mentioned that the Soviets do. They want to stir trouble. They keep wars going. They keep terrorist groups in the field. And Lebanon is where they make trouble, as now they're fighting on behalf of Assad in Syria. Interestingly enough, the Saudis have just said they're going to give several billion dollars to the Lebanese government to try to strengthen the Sunnis and Christian forces. That's essentially what that means, to squeeze out Hezbollah. It's the Saudis are going to fight a proxy war, at least with their money, in Lebanon with Iran. But again, that the vice, the country in the vice there is Iraq. Back to Egypt. Who'd have thunk it? But as 2014 begins, Egypt's ruled by a popular military government. I'll let Jim comment on that. Russia. Well, you know, Vladimir Putin portrayed himself as the man of 2013, but 2014 starts with the Chechens, Dagestanis, or Muslim. Caucasus Muslim terrorists launching attacks in Russia just prior to the Olympics. And Jim had pointed this out, and I've seen a couple of other places that this as well. Putin had declared, Jim, you can correct me on this, was it 10 years ago or 12 years ago, maybe 13, that the terror problem in Russia was over because he had done the brutal things that are required, and it's not. So, and then a last thing, tribal chaos in sub-Saharan Africa. You can look at what we had this week on South Sudan. I think that's one of the most complete collections of information of what's happened in South Sudan since the night of December 15th. 2013, which sure does give you unfortunately granular feel for what happens when tribal war begins and how difficult it is to stop. That said, South Sudan's neighbors, Ethiopia, Kenya, and Uganda, and the UN have done a fairly good job of, as one can do internationally, from trying to stall Sudan from taking advantage of South Sudan's chaos. And I'm going to give some of the credit to that, to the concept behind the UN Intervention Brigade, which Jim was discussing there a few minutes ago in Congo, aggressive, offensive peacekeeping. That's changed some of the way the UN and quote unquote international community operates in sub-Saharan Africa. They're certainly witnessing that in the Central African Republic now. It'll be interesting to see how that trend continues, Dan, through 2015, the muscular peacekeeping, which is implying more muscular diplomacy in sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah, that will be. Jim, one of the things that our readership is really interested in is technology-type trends. We have a lot of hardware geeks, I guess we'd call them, including myself, that like to see where the weapons technology and like that is going. We've seen a slowing in the development of large arms over the last couple of years, but on the smaller front, we've seen a lot of innovation coming on. What is on the horizon from what you've read about and seen?
Well, with the shrinking defense budgets, which are a worldwide phenomenon, everywhere except East Asia, you have less money to spend on big projects, but there is more new technology and sufficient money to fund a lot of developments in small tech. One of the best examples is Samsung, which is, I think, now the world's largest smartphone manufacturer. They are developing military applications, including, secure, encrypted, communications, ruggedized smartphones, and apps for, purely military applications. The South Korean Army is actually using this, and the U.S. Army, which has a contingent over there, is paying close attention to it because the South Koreans have the technology, they have the will, and they have the means to make the stuff. So a lot of the, the battlefield internet stuff, which the American Army has been working on for decades, really, even before the internet became a popular item, the final, version or the most workable, a real practical version, may come out of South Korea, not North America. In terms of the other kinds of tech, you're seeing a lot more applications of technology coming out of commercial products. Again, the smartphone. The smartphone is changing everything. Although people say that, it's true. It's not just the way people lead their lives, but the way soldiers fight. You've been seeing this in Syria, for example, where the rebels have been seen, improvising, using apps, commercial apps, to better use their mortars, to aim them, the compasses you can get for your smartphone. I've got one in mine, and it's very handy. Not that I get lost that often because I stay in the city. It's for somebody out in a bombed out city where you can still get a signal, which is the case in many parts of Syria. That sort of thing can be a lifesaver and very useful. I mean, basically, it's a tool that didn't exist 5-10 years ago, and now, like has happened in past wars, when there's shooting going on and there's a shortage of official geeky goodies. The troops will improvise, and they have a lot more to improvise with now because technology has been arriving. New technology has been arriving at an accelerating rate for several decades now. I mean, if you think back, us old codgers back to the 60s and 70s, when there was a new thing every couple of years, well, now it's every couple of months. We half joke that a software update, is obsolete after a few months because, for any number of reasons, something, a new one has to come out. We just get used to it. But, 50 years ago, people would have been in shock. I said, what are you kidding? I just bought this thing. It's obsolete 6 months later. Of course, the hardware companies are disappointed because while they like this obsolescence, a lot of people don't agree with it. In other words, a lot of people are still using Windows XP, which came out, 2001, 2002, a 12-year-old operating system, which works just fine. But again, taking the historical perspective, you find out that this is not unique. Some of the first mainframe computers came out in the 1960s with the IBM 360 series. And some of those were still being used up into the 1990s. Why? Not because there wasn't cheaper and faster hardware available, but some businesses anyway, not a lot, had applications written. They worked. They kept working. And they were basically holding IBM's feet to the fire saying, you would support this iron as long as we wanted to use it. And IBM eventually had to buy these guys out because basically they were being asked to support, 20-year-old, very obsolete, hardware, because they made that rash promise back in the day when they thought, this is like Bill Gates infamously didn't say that why would anybody need any more than 640,000 bytes of memory? We can all laugh at that now, but when he said that back in the 80s, people said, well, yeah, what are you going to do with more than, 640K? So this rush of technology, even if the government is or the military is not officially putting money into new weapons and new military equipment, the troops, especially in a volunteer army where they're there for the semi-long haul, the minimum enlistment is 4-6 years, they are selectively chosen, so you get a very bright bunch of troops, they will improvise. And that's exactly what they're doing. So a lot of the new military technology, as we saw in the last 10 years in Iraq and Afghanistan, is not going to come from the usual defense contractors who simply aren't getting as much money as they used to and never did a lot of that money anyway, are not coming from these guys, the Beltway Bandits, as we lovingly call them down in Washington, but from the troops themselves and commercial off-the-shelf items, and they are basically doing things that would have thought impossible 10-20 years ago. So the big surprise is new tech isn't coming from where you'd expect it.
Now, Austin, I know you've actually seen this happen, but the technology push in especially the U.S. military has turned from a top-down thing to a bottom-up thing, right?
Not necessarily, but there is a bottom-up push. I mean, you could see that in the Rapid Fielding Initiative, the RFI of 2004, where suddenly troops and deployed troops in Iraq and Afghanistan got a special issuance of equipment. It included, in most cases, Danner, those very fine Danner all-weather boots, in part because they were already being used in Afghanistan. The troops were buying them, ordering them through the mail because they got better cold weather characteristics. There's nothing wrong with the desert boot that U.S. Army had field. It's just that that particular boot was more serviceable given many of the missions that infantry, in particular, this is mostly infantry war, had on their plate. You also got some of the this is something that we actually you can see this in some things that Jim wrote back in I'm going to say early 90s, may have been before that. There were some of the light nylon sweat wicking but warm undergarments were included in that because troops were already buying them. One thing that the RFI had, like here's a little technological twist. There was one type of those sweat-wicking undergarments, though, that doctors and medics had been seeing in burn wounds, melding into the burn wounds. So the RFI had and this is based on my memory of it, cotton T-shirts had some of those characteristics, but it was still cotton, which you wouldn't have the melting effect of, I'm trying to remember what the component was. It was nylon and another stretch polymer in those. But the threats here, I'm giving you the details on it, Dan. The push on that was from the bottom up, and it was on soldier types of soldier equipment that the soldier said, hey, this just works better than what we've been issued. And you saw some of that. You see some of that in every single war. It's just easier now to get it to the troops because of reliable air support, air transport, order it. But GPS, there were a lot of, in Gulf War, Kuwait War, 1991, Desert Storm, a lot of young soldiers ordered GPS units from the civilian market or had their parents, wives, friends, kids, whoever, send them GPS units, so they mounted them on their vehicles. Now, almost most vehicles have all types of situational awareness software and electronics. But in 91, that was a push from the bottom up, and it's an example of what Jim means by using equipment on the commercial marketplace for the military. But the thesis of your question was, most of it's coming. No, I'm not so sure about that. There are some major projects out there, but as Jim said, the problem with major projects is big money, and some of these systems, communication systems, and weapon systems. There's a reason to try to bring them to the battlefield. But the question is do you have the money to do all the adequate research and development before you even move into acquisition?
Well, on the Jim, on the big hardware side, we're seeing cutbacks in all the in the United States, and we're seeing this in other countries too. Cutbacks in the amount of aircraft that are being fielded. I kid often with friends of mine saying that soon our F-22 fleet will consist of four airplanes. With the cutbacks that have happened there, and the F-35 doesn't seem to be doing much better. And we've been reporting for some time that we continue to say that aircraft that we were going to take off the flight line, that we keep modifying it so that it can stay out there on the front.
Well, this is a debate that's been going on for some years now inside the Pentagon. In the Navy and the Air Force in particular, there's a growing contingent of officers who are urging that F-35 sales, which are going to the Navy and the Air Force and the Marines, be cut back and more emphasis be put on UAVs, you know, unmanned aircraft. And some of these unmanned aircraft are now are increasingly being built so they can operate completely autonomously, you know, like a guided missile. Which most guided missiles are not really guided. They basically, their guidance comes inside, from inside the missile. So this whole fear of, you know, robotic weapons is a little late because they've been around for over a century, you know, especially since World War II, where you had wake homing and sound homing torpedoes. You know, as the technology matures and gets cheaper, faster, more reliable, more of these weapons simply become more prolific and more effective. I mean, that's what happened, you know, in 1991. We saw the smart bombs, they were a small minority of under 10% of the bombs used, but they hit the majority of the targets because they're smart bombs. By 10 years later, 12 years later, when we were in Afghanistan, almost all the bombs being used were smart bombs. And now, of course, there are smart artillery shells, smart mortar shells, smart rockets. Everything's got, you know, built-in intelligence. And this is going to, you know, change everything because that's simply the way, you know, technology matures. A lot of people inside the Pentagon say, look, let's not screw around. This is the future. Let's speed it up before somebody else does.
Right. And the thing with one of the things that people don't realize sometimes with the UAVs and the technology that's not manned is that instead of taking 10 years to go through a generation of hardware development, it comes down to a couple of years now, because we're like at the present time on our fourth and fifth generation UAVs that have come out since, 2000, 2001 that the companies have been pushing out, because you don't have to have all the redundancy and like that in the aircraft to protect the human that you do in a human powered aircraft.
Well, not only that, but off the shelf technology allows other countries who see this, who can't afford this stuff, you know, that the big players are using. They find that they figured out that, hey, you know, we can produce our own. A current example is in the Philippines, where just a few months ago, the Filipino army spent $100,000 of that to develop two small UAVs. Now, they've seen the Raven, which we've been using prolifically. Over 10,000 have been bought by the American military, you know, since, I think, 2006. It costs about $30,000. It weighs about, you know, 2 kilos, you know, about 4.5 pounds. And it does the job. It's very popular. But Filipinos said, man, we can't afford 30 grand. You know, we're always broke. But they said, you know, a lot of these Filipinos, these are young guys, you know, who are into tech. It's a global phenomenon. They said, yeah, but you know, you go on the internet and there's this commercial, you know, recreational, you know, stuff. And they basically built, in effect, cheap Ravens. I mean, you look at them. I mean, they're not. They look sort of like your typical a large type, you know, remote control airplane. You know, used for as a well an adult toy, as it were. But they found, hey, you know, we can get these. We can get a vid cam on there. You can buy. I mean, for a couple hundred bucks, you can buy a night vision vid cam. You can work up a data link. Now, again, it isn't as cool and as reliable and as solid as the Raven, but it gets the job done. And they've used it in several major operations, you know, in the last few months, and they're in love with it. And it costs about one-tenth of what the Raven costs. Well, actually, they got just like in the real world, so to speak. The first version cost about 10% of what the Raven cost. The second version, which has got more bells and whistles, cost twice as much. So you can see where that trend is going, even on the low end. But it's another example. There are many like that, where because of this, the worldwide proliferation and ease of access to, you know, technology worldwide, something that did not exist 20 years ago. I mean, it's revolutionized everything. And again, only old farts like us. You remember back in the old days when you had to go to a library. What's a library? We use typewriter. What's a typewriter? And that's why a lot of older people are in shock. You know, they won't use a computer. You know, the internet they stay away from. But some of us are still young at heart, and we're all over this stuff. But for the troops who know nothing else, they say, look, I see your solution. I did a little Googling around. And here, let's do it. We can do it at a price we can afford. And bingo, the Filipino Army has affordable UAVs that they otherwise would not have.
The Filipino example is a good international example of pressure from the bottom up there. And that's with a system, though, that, as Jim points out, that the troops were familiar with. So there you go.
Well, we should see this trend accelerating. DARPA has actually, over the last 10 years, embraced the concept of, instead of going out to individual universities and saying, here's a bunch of money, develop something for us, they've gone and said, okay, we're going to have a prize. And they get 20 universities, sometimes even international groups, competing for their prize for some of their autonomous vehicle competitions, where, you know, before they had cars and the autonomous vehicles, these were ground vehicles, could only navigate a few hundred yards. Now they're racing across the Baja every summer, totally uncontrolled by man, but just by software. It's amazing.
Yes, but the idea of prizes is something that governments who can afford it tend to stay away from because they don't like this idea of losing control of innovation and what have you. But on the commercial side, and you've seen more of this, you've seen private prizes, not just, I mean, DARPA was a brilliant inspiration, you know, going back almost 50 years, to basically unleash what was first seen in World War II, where you had a lot of American GIs who had grown up on the new tech, radios, you know, automobiles. I mean, this was radically new stuff back then. We tend to forget that. And they ran with it. They did a lot of innovations were coming from the troops at the front, and the officers who were lieutenants who were sometimes involved with that back during the war. Once they got up to the higher middle, mid high levels in the Pentagon, they said, you know, it worked then. It'll probably work better now. And I was one of the guys, the civilians they brought in back in the 70s and 80s. And I had noticed this, the same thing. And I was telling them this. I says, this is what you got to do. When they came to me for help, you know, in creating, you know, professional war games, I said, you know, you can take a lot of the stuff that we're selling to civilians and using your own troops, you know, and I know you have troops in the military who can use these things. They buy them with their own money, who know how they work and can modify them. I know that because when I was in the Army, in my one artillery battalion, I found at least 10 guys who, you know, knew how to play these things and did it on their own time and bought them with their own money. That's in one battalion. So, you know, do the math, guys. And they did, you know, year by year. I keep going down to the war colleges and giving my chats and whatnot and schmoozing with people afterwards. And there were more and more, and they were higher ranking. So by the late 80s, I had generals coming up to me, shaking my hand. I says, you know, we did such and such. You recommended when I was a colonel back in the Army War College at work. I get letters. And so it was a trend that didn't need a spark. It just needed a little push from time to time to make it go a little faster. But now it's, according to some, out of control. But as Austin points out, you know, it's taken for granted. So this is not the wave of the future. This is the wave of the present.
Right. And it's just going to accelerate. Well, that's a good place to wrap it up. And
exactly.
We'll be talking to Austin and Al next week about 1914, the beginning of the Great War. And so those of you that want to tune in and listen to that, look forward to that.